Hey everybody, and welcome to the second edition of the Medieval Podcast. First of all, I really want to thank everybody who emailed me over the last couple of weeks almost. Yeah, it's been a while since I did the first show. It's been great. I told myself I'd do another show if maybe 20, 30 people would subscribe to this over the week or so, and honestly, that happened about 3 hours after the show was up on iTunes, and listenership has been growing ever since, and so I'm really excited about it. It also really makes me nervous doing this show now, because I think there's actually people listening, and so if I really mess up, somebody's going to tell me. But I guess that's part of the fun of actually having some people listen to this, so I can't really complain. And I would really like to thank all of you who emailed me over the last couple of days. It's really been great, and I hope I got back to everybody, but if I missed you, don't take it personal. I'm sure I read your email. Now, some of you have given me some really great feedback and some really great ideas as what to talk about and what you'd be interested in, and so I'm looking at a lot of those ideas. But what I want to do, I've got something I want to do the first couple of shows that just, you know, I need to set the stage for right now, and that's what I'm going to do in this first episode now. And then as we go along, I'll get into some of the things that you guys have talked about in your emails. But let's see. What I want to talk about in this first episode of this series is I want to talk about the early Anglo-Saxons in England. And one of the reasons for that is it's really my specialty, and because there's some really cool stories to be told about them as well. So in order to do that, I just want to give you a bit of a background of what's going on, where do these people come from, and, you know, what's their story. Just some of the basic history, really, because I don't quite yet have a feel for what, you know, the listeners know about the history of the Anglo-Saxons, for example. So, you know, keep the feedback coming. If you think it's too basic, by all means, let me know, and I'll move on to something very different. But right now, I want to just give you the basic background of who the Anglo-Saxons are. And actually, it's not that easy, because the problem with the period is really that we know very little about it, and that our sources come from at least 100 to 300 years after the fact, after the coming of the Anglo-Saxons to England. Now, for some, it might come as a surprise that England wasn't always occupied by the Anglo-Saxons, but what happened was England was occupied by the Britons, who were then by themselves occupied by the Romans very quickly. And in the beginning of our period, the Romans start leaving Britain, and that's the year 407. So really, for England, the beginning of the Middle Ages is the end of the Roman occupation, if you want to you know, tie this in with what I talked about last week. In the year 407, the Roman troops are called out of England and have to fight in Gaul. Basically, with that, effectively, Roman government in Britain has ended. And one of the great, great historians that looked at this was E.M. Stanton, who said quite pointedly that between the end of the Roman government in Britain and the emergence of the earliest English kingdoms, there stretches a long period of which the history cannot be written. Now, that's a pretty disturbing idea, really, for any historians, that we're dealing with a time of which the history cannot be written. But I think at this point we've pretty much pieced together what happened. Now, if you look at the landscape of England in the year 410, to the north you've got the Scots and the Picts, and then you've got Hadrian's Wall, which the Romans built to protect their territory from the Scots and the Picts up in the north. And then to the south of Hadrian's Wall you have the Britons, who, now that the Romans have left, are suddenly all by themselves. And that's a bit of a problem for them, because obviously they don't have great relations with the Scots in the north. We've got two sources that tell us about all of this. I mean, there's a few more, but two main sources that people rely on. One of them is Gildas, who writes, he's a monk, obviously, like most of the people that you know, we're going to talk about. Gildas writes in 550, and the other source we have is the Venerable Bede, who writes the history of the, well, actually not the history, the ecclesiastical history of the English people in 731. Now, Gildas is quite an interesting character, and it's kind of a weird text to read because he's mainly occupied with quoting scripture and calling the British rulers to repent for all their sin. He's not that interested in writing history. History to him is just a way of showing them, hey, guys, you've really messed up. Look, all the problems we have is because you didn't believe in God. And that's, you know, that's not, for us historians today, that's not exactly what we expect our historians to write about. So he's really, really biased. And his story is still very good because, you know, it is one of the few stories we have that are being told about this. And also because he writes about 150 years after the fact, we can still assume that most people had some kind of idea of what reality was. You know, there must have been other stories out there. There must have been an oral tradition about this. And so he's probably not veering too far off from that because his audience would immediately detect that he's saying something that's completely out of the ordinary. Now, his story is very interesting, and it's pretty much close to what we think happened. The Romans leave in 407, and the Britons are suddenly faced with the fact that they have to fight all by themselves, and they don't do so badly, really. Gildas doesn't give us a name, beat us later on. Vortigern takes over the rule over the Britons, and pretty much keeps the Scots and the Picts behind Hadrian's Wall. But it becomes increasingly clear that it's just a question of time before there'll be some real trouble. And so he asks the Romans for help. Now, the Romans just left. Maybe they'll come back and help out. But they have absolutely no interest in doing so. And so they don't get any help and have to defend themselves. Now, as the Romans are not coming, Vortigern has to go out and ask somebody else for help. And the logical thing to do is just ask the next door neighbor, which at that point would have been the Saxons. Now, next door neighbor might be a little bit, you know, exaggerated, but we also shouldn't think of England as really being isolated in the water. There was a lot of traffic going back and forth, and the simple fact that he could call up on the Saxons to come and help him just tells you that, you know, there was some kind of connection between the two. Vortigern asks the Saxons to come for help, and they come. They come led by two rulers who Bede tells us are Hengist and Horsa. They're called, if you translate that, it means stallion and mare. So you might want to think, you know, how realistic is this? But anyway, that's the names we've got. Now, the Saxons send three ships and then some more. That's what we get to here. And the thing is, really, there must have been a lot and a lot more. And these people come from three tribes out in what today is kind of northern Germany and the border with Denmark. And these three tribes are the Saxons, the Angles, and the Jutes. Now, they serve the British quite well, but then there's a dispute over rations, and that leads to a revolt very quickly, and they ravage the whole island, all the way up to the Western Sea. So you have to imagine they're coming from the east and they're ravaging the whole island up to the west. Now that tells you there must have been a lot more than just three ships coming in. The problem here is we don't quite exactly know the dates because Gildas doesn't tell us when exactly it happens. So got a bit of an issue there as a historian. But we know that by 493, the British managed to kind of keep things under control again. They don't push the Angles and the Saxons and the Jutes back at all. But there seems to be a status quo that gets achieved in 493. And what has happened is that there was a Roman, Ambrosius Aurelianus, who took over power among the Britons and led them to a victory in a very decisive battle. And it's called the Battle of Mons Badonicus. Now, the problem with that is we have absolutely no clue where that happened. And so there's nobody who can really go out and get archaeological evidence for this or anything. We just have to take Gildas and people writing after him by word that this battle happened. Now, for a lot of people, this is a really interesting point, because some people think this Ambrosius was or is the role model for King Arthur. Some people think King Arthur came afterwards, but around this time, this is a great time for the Britons, because they've just reestablished themselves in their own country. They've kind of at least stopped the invasions. It's good time, and this is where the King Arthur legend begins, which, you know, a lot of people have been discussing, is King Arthur real? You know, is he just a fictional character from the romances? Honestly, I don't know. I personally venture more towards thinking he's a fictional character, but maybe another time we can discuss this in some more detail. Now, what happens is, you know, for Gildas, Gildas dies while there is still the status quo. So to him, this is really the high point of history. You know, we fought back, you know, God is with us. Now, it's a little bit different for Bede, who writes in 731, and he is seeing that the British didn't quite assert themselves in the long run, because what happens, according to Bede, is that the British grow decadent during this time of peace and commit all kinds of crimes. But the worst crime for Bede, that, and this tells you where Bede is coming from, the worst crime they commit is that they are not preaching the Christian faith to the newcomers. You know, just that by itself tells you a little bit about Bede himself. What happens is over time, there's a lot of intermixing between the races, between the Anglo-Saxons, Jews, and the Britons. Historians, not too long ago, still assume that what really happened was it was a complete slaughter. The Anglo-Saxon and Jews just come in and slaughter everybody. And most evidence today points to the fact that that's pretty much wrong. And a lot of this evidence is actually, it's quite interesting. It's from genetic research. You know, just look at the gene pool, and it seems like there's a lot of intermixing going on. Clearly, the Anglo-Saxons become the rulers of the country, but they do not slaughter everybody, and that was the old idea. So around the year 600, we've pretty much established the Anglo-Saxon state at that point. And that's where I'm going to leave you for today. Next time I'll talk about what happens in the next 300 years or so, but I think 15 minutes have already passed, and it's more than enough to deal with. And what I'll do is I'll put up Bede's text online. I'll put up some maps online if you want to look at what's happening. And maybe I'll just put some links up to some other secondary sources that might be interesting to read if you're so inclined. And I'd really like to thank you for listening. And I'll have another show up very soon. I'm sure won't take as long as this time, because now I actually have my little setup going on here. So thank you very much. And any feedback, as always, is very much appreciated. Thank you. Bye-bye.